Welcome to Podcast 83, a regular look at the news, stories, and trends related to Michigan's 83 counties, from Keweenaw to Monroe, Chippewa to Berrien. Brought to you by the Michigan Association of Counties. Here's your host, MAC Executive Director Stephen Curry.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Podcast 83. This is Megan Kite, Government Affairs Associate for the Michigan Association of Counties. We are very excited today to have Terry Schuster with the Pew Charitable Trust here. He is leading the group from Pew staff that is here working on the Michigan Joint Task Force on Jail and Pretrial Incarceration. Welcome, Terry.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, MAC's been involved with this for now quite a few months. Back in November, we started talking to you guys. And now it's really been, you know, full speed ahead with the data collection. Yeah. And so just tell us a little bit about the background of Pew and what you guys are doing here in Michigan.
Sure. So Pew Charitable Trust is a family foundation. We do nonpartisan data analysis and research on a wide variety of issues. And when we provide technical assistance, like we are here with the Jails Task Force, it's about bringing those data and research skills to really tough policy conversations to make sure everybody has kind of a grounding in, well, what does the data say? What does the research say? So we have this project and it's focused on county jails. And it's been a big question for everybody because everybody knows, or at least everybody from MAC and the state leadership offices came together around this problem statement of why have jail populations tripled in the last 35 years? What's that about? And it's been hard to get at the reasoning behind that growth or to understand that growth because the relevant data sort of scattered across 83 counties. And while the state's been having lots of policy conversations related to the prison population, all that data is centralized with one state agency. It's much harder to sort of piece together data from a whole lot of different counties, get some sense of who's coming into county jails, how long are they staying, what is it costing, and does it have to be that way, and why has it grown so much?
Right.
This is a joint task force because it's the counties joining with the state. And a lot of the laws and policies that sort of decide who goes to jail and how long they stay are state level laws and policies. But the cost and the growth, sort of the impact is all felt at the county level. And so it's important for both of these parties to really understand what's going on beneath the surface, try to open up this closed world with some data. And we worked a lot with the Sheriff's Association. They've really put in a massive amount of work to get a large representative sample of county jail data.
Yeah.
And now we have a lot of that data.
Yeah. It's been really fascinating thus far at some of the task force meetings and the presentations that you guys have been giving. So let's talk a little bit about that data collection process, though, because you have 20 out of 83 counties that you're working with and those sheriffs and the jails there, which is, you know, pretty significant sample size when you talk about the level of detail that you guys are going into. And I think at one point we talked about it in population, which is about 60% of the population that you guys are basically covering with these 20 counties. So what has that process been like so far? And you talk about that tripled growth. And what does that look like, urban to rural areas? The cost, what do you guys see as a total cost to the counties in providing jail services to these, you know, both pretrial and sentence populations? And just talk about some of the findings that you guys have presented so far.
Great. So what we've done with the Sheriff's Association is get a lot of individual sheriffs to share data about everyone coming in and leaving their jails for a 3-year period. And we initially thought that we could get a good estimate based on a sample of 10 jails. We were able to get double that, 20 jails. And this is it's a large jail sample. It's a massive amount of data about admissions and releases from jail. And we're able to supplement that with statewide data, 10 years worth of data from the courts and 10 years of data on arrests in the state. We also have some budget data. So we know, for example, that county taxpayers are spending about $500 million every year on jails. And that's just the operating cost of jails. So every time that a county takes out debt for building a new facility or a larger facility, that's generally hundreds of millions more in taxpayer costs. And that's spread out over time, but jails are a pretty large, substantial portion of county budgets. And a big piece of that is things like medical care or the cost of booking people in, the cost of 24/7 supervision of people in jail, and then the cost of any time there's some kind of lawsuit about a death in jail or somebody giving birth in jail or a suicide in jail. There's all kinds of things that have to do with conditions of confinement. And the sheriffs are not able to sort of say no most of the time. Everybody who, you know, people who show up to the jail, it's not necessarily up to the sheriff who comes in and how long they stay. A lot of those kind of policy decisions are, they're made by judges or they're built into the law or they're made by members of other members of law enforcement, other police agencies. So some of the trends that we've seen so far, in addition to growth, we now have for the first time really ever a top 10 list of these are the most common reasons why people go to jail in the state of Michigan. So those things include things like drunk driving, driving without a license, theft, probation violations, drug possession. So a whole lot of things where there's room for a policy conversation around, do these folks need to go to jail? Does people, tens of thousands of people coming to jail for driving on a suspended license, what's that about? Let's talk about it.
Absolutely. And I know one of the large factors, especially in northern Michigan, and when we talked around a work group table or a kind of listening session with our northern counties and members up there, of course, mental health comes up. And it's just been something that Mac's been hearing for a really long time. And I think, you know, recognized nationally at this point. I know our partners at the National Association of Counties has a stepping up initiative that they've been working on for quite a few years to really raise awareness. And so that, of course, came up, and it just kind of ties right in with all of those medical costs and things that, you know, the sheriffs face and the county commissioners at the end of the day also have to pay for it. So how do you think that plays a part in the policy conversations? You know, how is that information being heard by the task force members, do you think, at this point? I mean, it seems like you have presentations from Wayne State University on this, a lot of conversations that have, you know, started around that. And so do you think it's something that the group is going to look into a little bit more for policy recommendations? And what do you guys think is going to come out of that?
So data about the prevalence of mental illness in jails is pretty hard to come by. There's some national studies that estimate that about 1 in 4 men and 1 in 3 women in county jails have a serious mental illness. There are 19 counties here that have partnered with the Center for Behavioral Health and Justice at Wayne State University to get a sense of the number of people landing in jails with serious mental illnesses and to try to do better about identifying and diverting them away from jails. But it's a lot. When we, you know, sat down, we did this roundtable with county commissioners up in northern Michigan, and we heard a lot about people landing in jail because there's not a lot of other places they can go, or because the only way to get them seen by a mental health professional or get to a psychiatric hospital bed or something like that would be getting in the car and driving 8 hours and then having to sit with them and kind of lose the officers for a couple of days or something like that.
Right.
And so the question of like how much of an officer's time can you take to try and find some correct placement for somebody that's got a serious mental illness, as opposed to, well, we have the jail and we can leave them in the jail. And what the Center for Behavioral Health and Justice has found is that not only are they landing in jail in pretty large numbers, but they're staying in jail longer than folks who don't have mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. And that may be because of these kind of questions of how long does it take to get them, to get someone a mental health evaluation, or how long, or maybe someone will stay in jail longer because there's not really some place for them to be discharged to. And so I think this is going to be an issue that the task force really wants to talk about. They've heard about it a lot in public testimony, that people show up and talk about their family members or their clients with mental illnesses who've landed in jail for a variety of reasons. And, you know, their directive from the executive board that created them is to recommend changes in state law and state budgetary decisions. And so it could be that they come out and say, these are the things that every jail ought to do in order to screen for mental illness and divert people away from jail who have mental illnesses in certain cases. Or it could be that they have a policy conversation that's more about funding and trying to, particularly in rural parts of the state that have seen so much jail growth, to try to identify what kind of resources, what kind of state money can be shored up to help incentivize and create and support alternatives to jail for people who have these behavioral health needs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it'll be a really interesting conversation as the task force continues discussion around all of this. And obviously, one of the big factors that you guys are looking at are also the, those that are in jails pre-trial. So these are people that are still presumed innocent and, maybe do have behavioral health issues, also don't get, Medicaid coverage at that point. And so what do you guys see from that pre-trial population and some of those even national resources that not only on the maybe health cost side and the medical cost side, but just kind of, impacting family and employment and all of these things that really wrap into that whole conversation about people sitting in jail.
Right. So everyone who gets arrested is going to jail, has a hearing before a judge where the judge sets bail. And if this person can afford to pay bail and can meet the other conditions of release, then they can get out during that pretrial period. And if they can't, they stay in jail. For most people, this hearing happens relatively quickly. It's within the first day of their being arrested. But if they can't get out in that first day, then there's a lot at stake for them personally. People who have a job, you can only miss so many days of work for being in jail before you don't have that job anymore. Or people who get arrested, if they're the sole caretaker of their kids, kids maybe go next door and stay with the neighbors for a day, but then, you stay in jail more than a couple of days, you lose custody of your kids. There's a lot of people don't even know where their kids are when they go to jail. So there's really high stakes for individuals. The public safety side of this is for, particularly in cases involving imminent danger to a victim or something like that, a couple of days in jail really can provide enough time for safety planning for that person and for coming up with sort of a respite period to make sure that things are de-escalated and that don't sort of continue to threaten an individual or the public. There are a lot of cases where people are going to jail for a situation that doesn't involve any kind of immediate threat. And for those folks, because of how destabilizing jail can be, it can often increase their likelihood of reoffending down the road, that people are more likely to reoffend if they don't have a job and if they've got a whole bunch of debt or if they, if their lives are really derailed by a short stint in jail, than if they are able to get out and keep that job and keep their house and keep their kids. And so this pretrial period, while people are awaiting trial, they're still presumed innocent, is a pretty high stakes period for everybody. And judges are trying to make the right and best decisions in each case. And because so many of them are just processing hundreds or thousands of cases, it's often really helpful for everybody to take a step back, look at the whole system at a 30,000 foot level, and try to say, are we doing right by everybody here? Are we getting the outcomes we want? And if not, could we change policies in some way that we're going to get better outcomes? So about half of the jail population on any given day is sitting there pre-trial. The other half has been sentenced to a jail term. This task force is going to look at both of those populations. For the pre-trial population, a lot of it is going to be about that decision about release or detention that's made by the judge and asking the questions, what should the judge be asking about, what kind of information can they have when they make that decision? And then for the person who is at risk of being detained pretrial, what kind of hearing are they supposed to get to make sure that their rights are protected?
Sure.
So they've got to talk through all of that.
Yeah.
We've got months ahead for those policy conversations, and this jail's task force is going to be moving in that direction. There's a lot more that they have to kind of talk through as a group and see where they land and then run those different policy ideas by sounding boards of their peers and their colleagues and the different practitioner associations to make sure that whatever ideas they come up with are actually going to work and actually going to be able to be implemented, not just in the biggest urban parts of the state, but also in less populated parts of the state.
Yeah. And speaking of that, let's talk about those next steps that the task force are going to take. You guys have had meetings around the state now and heard public testimony from a number of different groups and folks. And so now we're going to be, meeting in Lansing next. You have subcommittees that are being created. Obviously, as MAC members and the county commissioners that we represent, we have, encouraged them to take part in that testimony or provide information as they can. So talk about the next steps and then how our members can stay engaged and provide more information if needed to the group.
So where it's all headed is recommendations to the legislature at the beginning of January. January 10th is the deadline. Before January 10th, what this task force has decided to do is break up into smaller groups because there's 21 of them and it's hard to kind of come to agreement as a group of 21 on anything. And so you split into a few groups of seven and you can really hash out the details of different policy ideas. So for example, there's a group that's really going to dive deep on arrest versus arrest alternatives. So when should the law give an officer discretion to give someone a citation in lieu of arresting them? Or when should the law actually sort of give guidance about diverting people that have substance abuse needs away from the system and towards some kind of treatment provider, as opposed to making an arrest and bringing them into jail? When should the law require that someone be arrested and sort of talk through these things from the very moment of first law enforcement contact? What can law enforcement do for crime victims to make sure that they have some access to safety planning services or shelter services if they need it? Sort of talk through. So one group will sort of dive deep on arrest policy, and another group will dive deep on pretrial decisions that are made in the court. And another group will look really at probation violations, parole violations, misdemeanor sentences, the other things that can land somebody in jail or keep them in jail for a while. They'll kind of have these small group meetings, a couple of them, and then come back as a big group in the middle of November and start sharing how those ideas are mm-hmm. shaping up so that they can get feedback from one another and also get feedback from the public. So mark your calendars, everybody. November 19th, everyone's going to be here in Lansing. We have an all-day meeting where the morning session is about sharing those different ideas that have started to take shape. It's going to be in the Senate hearing room on the ground floor of the Bogie Tower. And it's a moment when anybody who wants kind of a sneak peek into how these ideas are shaping up and the kind of recommendations that will ultimately or that might ultimately land on the legislature's doorstep to get sort of a sense of where things are headed with that conversation.
Yeah, that's great. We are so excited, obviously, as representatives of the 83 counties and the 622 county commissioners around the state. They're very concerned both with the cost of our jail populations and also the public safety, right? So we're really excited to get the data and make some good policy decisions moving forward. So we really appreciate all your work, all your team's work, task force members' work on this. And, you know, please, members, stay in touch with our legislative updates and all the information on our website, as well as the jail task force website, because there's a lot of good information out there as well. So we look forward to your continued work.
It's been really a pleasure, and the Michigan Association of Counties has been a fantastic partner in all of this work. You know, I know that the counties are always looking for ways in which they can kind of align priorities with the state and really get the most out of the different conversations that are happening here in Lansing. And so this is a really easy one where everybody can align around jails. It can be a win-win for the state and for the counties. And particularly if we get all the right stakeholders around the table, we can land on some recommendations that everybody is happy with, and then we can get some better outcomes in the justice systems across the state.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again, Terry.
You're listening to Podcast 83 with news, features, and services related to Michigan's 83 counties. Learn more about everything county governments do at micountymatters.org.
Hello, welcome back to Podcast 83. I'm Derek Milo, MAC Director of Communications, and I'm talking today with Ken Borton of Otsego County and Stan Ponstein of Kent County about a trip they recently took to Washington, D.C. to get some briefings from officials at the White House. Ken, why don't you start us off and tell us a little bit about what you learned in Washington and how it can apply back to your county.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Derek. Appreciate that. First of all, it was a great opportunity to visit the White House and meet with the White House staff and administration. And of course, this is a follow-up visit. We were there 2 years ago. And this time, I believe we had 80 commissioners, I think, from Michigan, or 80 mm-hmm. county folks that attended. And I wasn't as impressed this time as I was the previous time, because I think the most important thing I got out of it is their need to hear from us, their desire to hear from us. So when they create these policies in Washington where they're just looking at data, they're throwing cash at it, and they're not really sure how effective it is. And they've made that very clear. We want to hear from you. We want to know, are the things we're doing, are they working? So that was a lot of it. We heard from 11 different folks from the White House, and I found it very informative again.
All right, great. Stan, your perspective a little different. Kent County, larger urban County compared to Kansas-Otsego, which is smaller, less urban. What was your perspective on what you heard in D.C.?
So, I mean, I think whether you're a large county or a rural county, I mean, it affects us all. I think one of the greatest things, like Ken said, is that we had 80 county office holders or stakeholders that were at that meeting. And that's pretty impressive because we always hear in Washington that we don't hear from you. You know, we don't know what your needs are. And then I know several of the people that spoke had said, how many are from Kentucky, how many from Ohio? And when you see 20 hands go up and 30, then you see 80 from Michigan, it tells them that the people that we've got elected value this. We value these opportunities to get our story out, but also talk not to some sub-level person that's employed by that department, but we're normally speaking to the director or the assistant director. And I think they are truly, I don't want to say concerned, but do the buy-in that they want to hear from us what's going on. You know, one of the best things of being an elected official is that, you know, in ways when the common person hears of a problem and tries to figure out who I talk to. I mean, we were there firsthand. We've got the email addresses of department heads. We've got the emails of government affairs people. So if an issue does come up in our county or any way in the 83 counties, we've got someone that we can contact, and I've already contacted one since I've been back, and they respond normally within the day of what your problem is or how they can help. And, you know, the answer is not always going to be, yes, we can fix that. Sometimes it's going to be no, but at least you're going to get the answer of why it's no and what maybe they can do to help us out.
Yeah. Anything you wanted to add?
Well, I was just going to say that is an absolute great point. The fact that we do have their contact information now is so important. But not only do we have their contact information, but we've had face-to-face contact with these people. So now when you call them, you've already had a conversation. They know who you are, and odds are pretty good they're going to take your call and do whatever they can. And like Stan said, they didn't tell us that means the answer is going to be yes every time, but you are going to get an answer. So you're not just wondering what is going on with my issue.
Yeah, and I think that's something to add on, too. I go home on my desk, and I got a stack of business cards of people that I've met. And I think the most valuable thing I do is on the back is when and where I met that person. Because when you're calling someone cold, they get a lot of calls during the day. If you can reference that, yeah, we've met and I've talked to you about that, that's normally going to get you by the administrative assistant and get you to someone that you're talking. So always take all opportunities as county commissioners to connect with people that you may not need their help now, but you may need their help down the road.
All right. Great tip, Stan. Stan, Ken, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Podcast 83, the go-to source for all information about Michigan's 83 counties.